Meyer will be joining us. Everyone else is present. Senator Dyson on the end over here to my left. Senator Ellis over to my right. And we have Senator next to me. I started to say vice chair. You're supposed to be his vice chair. He doesn't want to, but I asked him to anyway. So, are you going to accept?
Pardon?
Vice chair.
He did a marvelous job.
Whatever.
He did fill in for me on last
wonderful
last week, and they said he did a fantastic job. So being the vice chair might not be a bad role for you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to go on and get started. We're going to have overviews today, and I'm Senator Davis, Chair, Health and Social Services. We are going to have an overview from the Department of Health and Social Services. So they have most of the time, and when they're done, we're going to go into the Health Commission. They want to give us an overview of their report from 2010. And at this time, I'm going to turn it over to the Commissioner. And
good afternoon, Senator Davis, members of the committee. I'm Bill Stewart, Commissioner. I keep them wanting to say acting while they pay you. Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, and as Senator Ellis may point out, is I still have to be confirmed, but I'm partway there at least. So anyway, thank you very much for this time. What we're going to do is give you, with me is Allison Elgy, the Assistant Commissioner for Finance, and she and I will be tag-teaming this. To try to move it right along, but also to allow time for Deb to present on the Healthcare Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and thank you for allowing us to give an overview of the department and where we are. Starting from the top, you should have this document in front of you. It's a three-page front and back document. You won't really need it because I'm going to be talking you through it line by line just about. But starting from the top of it, the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services vision is that all individuals and families are healthy, safety, and productive. Our mission to promote it and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. So it is. It's all about Alaskans and health. Our general strategies are more integration of services, strategic technology use. You'll be hearing a lot about that through this session with all the technology efforts that we have going on that were first spawned with Senate Bill 133 a couple of years ago, Senator Pascrans' bill for HIE, Health Information Exchanges, Health Information Technology. Electronic health records will, beginning in the first quarter of this year, incentive programs are being developed for physicians and other healthcare providers. So we're entering the electronic age at the front end for a change. Alaska is one of the first states to implement the HIE, HIT, and electronic health record technology.
Before we go into any further, I'd like to recognize Senator Meyer. He did join us.
The third general strategy is promoting rural infrastructure development and standardization of regional structures and promoting accountability at all levels. I don't think there's a person in this room that hasn't heard me talking about we want the right care at the right time for the right people. One of the things that amazes me is that we're very good at spending $1.5 billion, but telling people exactly what we do has been an elusive animal for us to get a hold of. And that is going to be a significant effort of what we do, and it's going to dovetail nicely with our technology. Our 2011 priorities include first primary substance abuse and mental health services. I don't think there's an Alaskan that is not affected in some way by one of these areas. The contributing factors and many of the problems that we'd like to eradicate, from unemployment to domestic violence to suicide, they're part of everything that we read about. We're constantly refining the way we address these issues to be as effective as possible. With limited resources, it's a very difficult challenge to take on. We're promoting within this area prevention and health promotion. Targeted areas: underage drinking, binge drinking, excessive drinking, suicide, and domestic violence and sexual assault. You'll see throughout this entire presentation that these items are very much a part of it. For early intervention, we continue to work to integrate behavioral health with primary care. It's another amazing thing that we encounter is we see people every day in physicians' offices, and every day physicians' offices deal with the effects of alcoholism and mental health issues, and we seldom intervene on that. We need to work, do a better job of intervening with that and making sure that we're connecting the total health of the individual. We want universal screening and primary care settings for behavioral health. The Juneau School District, 23 to 40% of high school students have major depression or suicidal thoughts. We don't have 23 to 40% of high school students involved in our system. Treatment, our goals are to grow family-based treatment. The Family First program that DPA began is going to cross all of what we do. In every one of our divisions, we need to talk about families first. We need to increase access to substance abuse services, add in voluntary treatment and secure detox, ensure adequate response to behavioral health emergencies, increase use of telemedicine and telebehavioral health therapy, and again promote integration of behavioral health and primary care. Recovery, support an array of recovery services using performance-based standards and funding. We continue to integrate mental health and substance abuse services into a behavioral health system, and we're aiming to have behavioral health regulations in place this summer that reflect the philosophy of integration between mental health and substance abuse. Health and wellness, chronic disease has a staggering impact on Alaska. Our estimates are that direct medical services are $600 million and lost production is $1.6 billion. Add those two together and you've got the budget of the department. Most of this thinking is related to personal choice around diet, exercise, tobacco, and it's preventable. We're talking about obesity, tobacco, alcohol abuse, injuries, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and vaccine-preventable diseases. A little more on obesity, roughly 35% of Alaska children and 66% of Alaska adults are overweight or obese. Direct medical costs related to being overweight cost Alaska $477 million a year and now surpass those related to tobacco use. Major health and wellness strategies include prevention and health promotion, disease control, detecting epidemics and control the spread of infectious diseases, access using public health and other nurses to ensure that all possible resources are available in Alaska's communities. Emergency response and preparedness, building capacity in Alaska's statewide trauma system. Environmental health impacts provide medical, toxicological, and public health expertise to individuals and communities to enable them to reduce hazards from environmental exposure. Healthcare access and delivery. Alaska provides about 18% of its population with health insurance through Medicaid, and that continues to climb. Like other states, Alaska's Medicaid is hard-pressed to meet increasing demands for services. You'll be hearing a lot about that in upcoming budget meetings as we go forward. Technology for sustainable and effective health care has to be very much a part of what we do. Implementing a new Medicaid management information system, that seems to have been an ongoing effort here in the state of Alaska. We are going live with it on April 2012. We will be up and running this time, and we're going to move into, if not the 21st century, the 21st and a half century with the technology that we're proposing. Our current MMIS system, while it plays claims very well and accurately, doesn't give us much documentation. And every report we go to pull out of that system, because it's a non-relational COBOL-based system, has to be written from scratch. a very difficult and arduous process. The new system will have online full capabilities. Workforce development, partner with the University of Alaska and others to create new training opportunities for healthcare professionals. I think that you have all been approached at one by one group or another talking about growing the workforce. I know that there's two bills that have been introduced in the House addressing it. We do have shortages in almost every area of healthcare. Enhanced management of high health needs, improved coordination of care for individuals with the highest needs and the chronic health conditions. One of the rules of healthcare is that 15% of the population consume 85% of the healthcare dollar spend. In the state of Alaska, we're a little better. 15% consume 75% of the healthcare dollar. It's those folks that we need to focus on to make sure that they're getting the right care at the right time at the right place. Sustainable long-term care delivery system. We're back to Medicaid again. The primary payer for long-term care services for the elderly and disabled. Alaska has been successful in making services available in homes and communities and delaying entry into more expensive nursing home levels of care. Challenges, however, remain in the availability of home and community-based services in rural areas, institutional care for those individuals with high needs that cannot be met in the community, standardization of the quality of care delivered, and a comprehensive oversight of the health and welfare of these participants. We have the most rapidly growing 65 and older population in the U.S., so long-term care issues are just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Major strategies: identify and coordinate health and welfare needs, implement quality assurance strategies that set forth standards of performance for home and community-based providers, and remediation responses for failure to meet those needs. We need a better job of delivering the service, a better job of making sure that the service is delivered as stated. Promote a service array that meets the long-term care needs of underserved Alaskans. Collaborate with providers to develop sustainable options for institutional care that meet the needs of very complex individuals whose needs may not be safely met in the community setting. We need an alternative to the community setting for specific individuals. For individuals with long-term care needs related to complex behavioral issues and cognitive issues such as Alzheimer's, dementia, and other related diseases. Develop, integrate, and comprehensive model of care. Evaluate opportunities provided by the federal government to manage the benefits of dually eligible individuals. Vulnerable Alaskans. Family-centered services are the key to meeting the needs of our most vulnerable citizens and their families. Developmentally disabled children and adults should have access to quality services, and Alaskans should get the financial and vocational supports that they need to maximize their contributions to society. Strategies include protective services, providing effective and timely services to vulnerable children and adults. The challenge here is that we're seeing more reporting by providers and community members. That's not a bad thing. The good thing is that we are now taking it from behind the scenes to in front of us. Forging relationships with community partners, working together to develop proactive measures to reduce risk to vulnerable children and adults. Domestic violence and sexual assault. Strengthening behavioral health programs to address family violence prevention and to provide treatment for alcohol and substance abuse, and as well as all other underlying causes of domestic violence and sexual assault. The corrections, public safety, the Department of Health and Social Services are all working together on strategies for that. And in upcoming meetings and opportunities that I have, we're going to present to you some of the measures that we're proposing, beginning with the Iron Dog. So lots of good activities going on there. Strengthening behavioral health programs to address family violence prevention and provide treatment for alcohol and substance abuse. One large grant to Safe and Free, Fear-Free Environments for Dillingham. Three capacity building grants to Sitkins Against Family Violence, Association of Village Council Presidents to serve Bethel and surrounding villages, and Kodiak Area Native Association to serve Kodiak and several other villages in that surrounding area. I hope, as well as others, that this will provide a new chapter in expanding early prevention efforts, complementing the crisis response that exists around the state. Suicide prevention. You're going to hear about it throughout the session. Target suicide prevention efforts to those individuals and communities most in need. Bring the Kids Homes Initiative. Continue efforts to develop our infrastructure so we can serve kids in state. But more importantly, I think that we need to bring the kids home program to one of keeping the kids home. Developing infrastructure in our communities to be able to care for kids before they're put into an institutional setting, before they're sent anywhere but in their home neighborhoods. Family First Initiative, I talked about this at the outset. Expanding this project to help families leave the public assistance roles and find employment. The coordination of services between state agencies to assure that services are designed to meet family needs. Now we move into the budget, and if you would take your budget overview book, or look at the screen up there. The department has 3,690 individuals working in eight divisions within the department. Eight divisions are the Alaska Pioneer Homes, Behavioral Health Services, Children's Services, Juvenile Justice, Public Assistance, Healthcare Services, Senior and Disability Services, and Financial Management Services. Excuse me. Most important one sitting right next to me, so I apologize for that. The senior leadership staff involves Dr. Ward Herbert, our Chief Medical Officer and the Director of Public Health. The vacant position that was mine until a few weeks ago, Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services, Pat Heffley, and the Assistant Commissioner for Finance to my right, Allison Elke, who I will now turn over the floor to give the overview of the rest of the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Allison Elge. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Finance and Management Services for the Department of Health and Social Services. The Commissioner pointed out the page number for the budget overview book, which I believe all of you have received a copy of. For anybody that's listening, I do want to make mention of the fact that this is available on our website. It is on the home page, directly underneath the commissioner's picture. There is a link for this book. There is a wealth of information about the department and what we've got going on besides just budget-related information. The other book that I like to bring to people's attention because I think that it's a useful resource is our Fiscal Year 2011 Operating Grants Book. This would have been delivered to each of your offices two or three weeks ago now. This book provides detailed information on the over $160 million worth of grant funding that the department oversees on an annual basis. We have grants going to over 240 different organizations, and the book is organized in two ways. First, by program area, so that you can see all the grants that are going out for specific program efforts. And then the latter half of the book sorts these grants by election districts, so that you can easily see what kind of grants are being made to organizations within your district. Madam Chair, we're going to just go division by division. And if you or your committee members have questions, feel free to interrupt as we go along. First of all, just a big pie chart shows the different divisions within the department, how much each division comprises of the total $2.4 billion budget. You can see that by far and away the largest portion of the budget is made up of Medicaid services, and these are just the payments for services, not any of the administrative oversight of that program. The first division we're going to talk about is the Alaska Pioneer Homes. The Alaska Pioneer Homes employs 557 full-time staff, 43 part-time staff. They do this to operate six homes throughout the state. We have Pioneer Homes in Sitka, Ketchikan, and Juneau, in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and in Palmer we have a state pioneer and veterans home. So those six homes comprise the system that we'll be talking about today. One of the things that I like to point out when you look at the staffing versus the number of people, we have about 508 licensed beds. It seems like an extraordinary staffing level for that, to meet the needs of those 500 residents. But it's important that you keep in mind that these are 24-hour, 7-day-a-week facilities. And in order to operate them, we essentially run 3 shifts each day. So in looking at this staffing, it is, if you were to divide by 5, you get a better sense. That's not quite right, but it gives you a better sense of what kind of coverage we have at any given time during the operations, the 24-hour cycle, to meet the needs of the residents. As I said, we have 508 licensed beds in our Pioneer Home system. We are licensed as assisted living facilities. We do not provide nursing home level of care, although a number of our residents meet nursing home level of need. But when they get to the point where they need intravenous feeding tubes or that sort of medical attention, we are no longer capable of providing those services. In order to be a resident of the Pioneer Homes, you must be at least 65 years of age and have been a resident in the state 1 year prior to seeking admission. And we maintain 2 wait lists for Pioneer Home services. We maintain an inactive wait list where once people meet eligibility criteria, they can sign up and essentially preserve their place in line for some point in the future when they might want to actually go into the Pioneer Home. When people activate their application and move on to the active wait list, it means that you are interested in residency and you are obligated then, once an invitation is issued, to make a decision whether or not you're going to move into the home or not within 30 days. We charge fees for the Pioneer Homes ranging from our lowest level of care, level 1, at $2,350 a month. This is a level of care that requires very little assistance, to our highest level of care, level 3, where we charge $6,170 a month. And that is a level of care where people need 24-hour attention and a lot of assistance with their activities of daily living. We are eligible for Medicaid waiver revenues in the Pioneer Home program, and those individuals who are unable to meet the payment rates go through an eligibility determination to see if they are eligible for waivered services. If the waivered services are not available to the individual, we have a state payment assistance program for folks in the Pioneer Homes. No one is asked about financial resources as part of the admission process. It is only once they are actually in the Pioneer Homes that they cannot make the payment obligations, then we work with those individuals to determine what else could be available to them. Our biggest problem in running the Pioneer Homes, the challenges that we're struggling with, besides those that you'll hear throughout the department of just workforce needs, are the increasing acuity of the residents. We're seeing a very steep curve in terms of the increase in acuity. Since 1995, which was the base year that we have measured, we had 63% of our residents in the Pioneer Homes at that time seeking the highest level of care. Today, that is 88% of all of the residents. And the average age of our residents is over 85 years of age. So it is a struggle to keep up with these needs with what has been essentially a flat level of staffing. The second issue that we are really struggling with in the Pioneer Homes is the lack of available placements for individuals exhibiting difficult behaviors. Sometimes people, especially as they go through a progression with their dementia, can end up being assaultive, where they are a danger to not only themselves, but to staff and to other residents. When we end up with a resident who exhibits those kind of behaviors, we often find it necessary to put one-on-one staffing with that resident to assure the protection of the other residents within the home, and we frankly are not funded to staff at that level. Unfortunately, there are no alternative placements for individuals with these very, very difficult behaviors. I'm going to move on now to the Division of Behavioral Health. Oh, I should, before I forget, I just wanted to mention that the director of the Division of Alaska Pioneer Homes is Dave Cody, and I did see him walk in, and Dave's here, so just wanted him to wave at you so you had a face. Okay. The next division is the Division of Behavioral Health. This division is managed by Melissa Stone. Melissa is not able to join us today, but the Division of Behavioral Health has 334 full-time people and 11 part-time people. The majority of the staff in this division are staff that are employed to operate the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, which is included in this particular division. API has 240 full-time people and 9 part-time people. So you can see that's two-thirds of the numbers that I just cited. With the exception of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute and the ASAP program, the Alcohol Safety Action Program, the bulk of the work of the Division of Behavioral Health is in the management and oversight of the grant programs that we distribute throughout the state to numerous nonprofit and community provider partners to deliver a variety of behavioral health services, beginning with prevention services that the commissioner spoke to all the way through treatment.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I make a comment?
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Allison, for the information. And I wanted to ask the commissioner if he was aware of the fact that less than half the money that we collect in the current state alcohol tax goes back out for cost-effective, evidence-based treatment programs across the state. That's a goal of mine, is to up that percentage of money that comes from the existing alcohol tax to be committed through your budget to those kinds of programs. So I don't know if you were aware of that figure, but if you wanted to comment on that. And then I also wanted to have you and Allison comment on the fact, something that I had raised with you in private, just how long it takes to get the grant monies after we appropriate them in our fiscal year budget out onto the street to the nonprofits that are providing a lot of the treatment programs across the state. The number of treatment programs are wholly inadequate in this state, whether it be in prison or in the communities, in my opinion, and the opinion of many others in the field. But we appropriate some level of money from the half of the alcohol money that comes in. So we could commit more in the future at the legislative level, but it seems to take a long time for these wonderful, hardworking people in behavioral health to get the grant money out on the street after it's appropriated. And it is literally a life or death situation with some people who are battling this disease of addiction. So can you speak to those two things, if you would, please?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis. No argument with either of those two points. Having dealt with alcohol taxes in several states, it's the sin tax, as we frequently refer to that, it is more than about treatment. It's getting to the right allocation of dollars, of those dollars to the field, because the tax also has to go for paying for the costs of criminal justice system, the cost of safety, the cost of health care itself, beyond the alcohol and other drug treatment centers. And I think we continue to work toward moving more and more toward prevention and toward that goal that you have, earlier interventions and those kinds of things, because that is where the value is going to be ultimately. And I just lost the second issue. I apologize.
I'll speak to that.
Speed of getting the grants out on the street.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Ellis. You are correct that the new money that comes to us can often be a struggle. We are obligated by statute to competitively solicit for grants, And we do ordinarily competitive solicitations for 2 to 3 year grant cycles, just to make sure that we have some continuity in our program delivery and to avoid the difficulty of having all of the grants go out on a competitive basis every single year. This enables us to get those grants awarded and available to the grantees July 1st, except for those that are brand new money, where we frequently do not even know that we're going to be receiving increased funding until April, when the legislature has concluded its business. And there can often be a delay for those brand new competitive solicitations. We try whenever possible to utilize when there is new money directed for purposes that we are already trying to meet, to utilize existing grantees, at least in the initial year. And an example of that was the money that was provided this fiscal year to expand methadone treatment. We amended the provider agreements for, there are only two, well, one provider providing in both Anchorage and Fairbanks. We amended those provider agreements and were able to get that money out immediately. But for a brand new concept, and that was true of our domestic violence grants this year, we had to do a competitive solicitation for those grant proposals, and that does delay awarding those grants into the new fiscal year by several months.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to Ms. Elgee, so you're positive that the money, it's only new money that takes a long time to get out. The money that continues over a 2 or 3 year period is fast or near instantaneous, because I've just heard lots of complaints from grantees, and it didn't seem it was just about new money. It seemed like it was all the money through the division seemed to take forever from, you know, people providing the services. And forever is a subjective term, yeah. I suppose, from these folks. But I didn't think it was just new money that people were complaining about the speed of the division to get this processed.
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, if you've got specific program areas, I can certainly look into them. But we have worked for the last 3 years very specifically on improving our grant-making processes and on speeding up the payments to grantees. And I think that we've been very successful. We're providing for the small grantees, I think 90% of the grant dollars in July. As I said, we are looking at 2 and 3 year grant cycles simply to avoid some delay in the grant process. And in order for those grants that are competitively solicited to be awarded and available to the grantees come July, we start that process in December. Okay. Just to wrap up our Division of Behavioral Health, I wanted to make specific mention of the fact that this division has worked very hard at incorporating program performance standards into their grant review process. It has got off to a little bit of a rocky start, but we feel that at this point we're making very good progress with grantees. They are understanding what we're looking for in terms of program outcomes, and we are actually making grant award decisions based on the performance of the individual grantees. Also, in the Division of Behavioral Health, for administrative purposes, you will find attached the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Alcohol and Substance Abuse Advisory Board, and the Suicide Prevention Council. The biggest issue that we face in terms of delivering behavioral health services really is our geography and the small populations that we're trying to serve make having trained behavioral health resources at the community level sometimes difficult, if not impossible. We've been doing some work to try to determine where the gaps exist and what could be solutions for that continuity of care, because what we're seeing as a result of a lack of community resources is oftentimes inappropriate referrals to API. And our Alaska Psychiatric Institute census is running at 100%. The next division I want to speak about is the Office of Children's Services. Christy Lawton is in the audience. Christy, if you would like to wave. Christie is our acting director of the Office of Children's Services, has been in that role since August. We are in the process of doing a recruitment for a permanent director for this division, but that's just getting going now. This division employs 499 full-time people. We're organized in our delivery of services here around five regions. The five regions are, four have been in place for quite some while, but we have just created a fifth region to serve Western Alaska. Western Alaska was previously served through the South Central region housed in Wasilla, and there were some difficulties as a result of that distance. So this has proved to help the service help manage the operations of that Western region. We also have 26 field offices that comprise those different regions. The primary operation is to provide child protection services and respond to reports of harm that come into the offices, make sure, check out what the situation is, and try to provide whatever resources are necessary to assure the safety of the child. But in addition to that, this division also manages the Infant Learning Grant Program, which provides early childhood services to children 0 to 3 that evidence developmental delays. And they also oversee the grant funding for our child advocacy centers. We have 9 fully operational child advocacy centers, and we are working with Kodiak to bring up a 10th in FY12. The biggest issue that we are facing in the Office of Children's Services really is around our workforce. This is an extraordinarily high-stress environment for these workers, and recruitment and retention continues to be a struggle, not only in our rural areas where it's very difficult oftentimes to employ people who have a lot of experience in the field, but also in the urban areas as a result of the just stressful nature of the job. The division did a study in 2009, and it found at that time that over 60% of their frontline social workers had held their current position for less than 2 years. This is not a complete 60% turnover, I want to make that clear. It's because a number of these people promoted within the organization, but in terms of how long individuals had been in their current position, over 60% had turned over.
Yes. Senator Dyson?
Have you done exit interviews with those folks or gotten a handle on what are the major dissatisfiers in their job?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, yes, we do exit interviews. We do them both confidentially and conversationally, trying to better understand what some of the issues are with the employees, and our director could speak at greater length, and perhaps I could ask her to visit with you about that, but I think that some of the things that we're doing there are trying to strengthen our supervisory staff, because that's one thing we hear over and over again is the need to have good, strong supervisors.
If I might follow up, yeah, the reason I address the question to you is if we doubled the money, would it cut in half or greatly reduce the amount of turnover? You're right, it's a very stressful job dealing with people in under nearly the worst circumstances.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I doubt very much that we could spend the money if you were to double it, because there is just a shortage of good qualified talent in this field. And our salary surveys that have been done not by Health and Social Services but by the state indicate that the salaries are competitive. There is some question about really truly if that is the case, but that is what the surveys have shown. So. While reducing caseloads for the individual workers, I think, would only be positive, I'm not sure it's all about money.
Yeah, I'd enjoy a further conversation about that. Thank you.
Before you go any further, position for the director has been vacant since about July, before that.
Senator Davis, that position became vacant the 1st of August.
1st of August. Mm-hmm. What's the long delay in? You said you're just now getting to the point where you're getting ready to interview someone for a permanent job?
Yes. Senator Davis, we were very, very fortunate that Ms. Lawton was available to serve as an acting director. She's provided a great interim management for the division, but quite frankly, it is very difficult to recruit into these positions in an election year. And so we were simply holding off until after the outcome of the election.
Problem is, Superman doesn't live here.
You make a kid. Yeah.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm going to move on now to the Division of Healthcare Services. If there are no further questions about the Office of Children's Services. Our Division of Healthcare Services is managed by Kimberly Poppy Smart. Kim is also in the audience. Kim has been with us for a while now, but has served in a temporary capacity as the acting director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services, working through the issues that arose as a result of the need for a corrective action plan from CMS in managing our waiver programs. Beginning in December, she was moved back into her role as healthcare services director and is there now managing that program on a daily basis. Healthcare services is our primary management structure for our Medicaid services programs. There are 134 staff authorized in healthcare services. This division manages the acute medical care components, hospital services, and the Denali Kid Care program. It is the primary piece of Medicaid, as I said, but I just want to make it clear that we still maintain a connection to Medicaid in our other Medicaid divisions, the Senior and Disability Services Division and in Behavioral Health for those component parts. But Healthcare Services manages the contract for the third-party payment environment with affiliated computing services. They run the MMIS system and act like a third-party payer for services provided by Medicaid providers throughout the state. They also provide the rate review process for all of our Medicaid rate settings. The biggest challenges that we're faced with in healthcare services is in terms of trying to maintain a balance between the rates that we pay for Medicaid and providers that are willing to serve the Medicaid program. Because what we're trying to assure here is access to healthcare throughout the state for those people who utilize Medicaid as the primary payer. When services are not available in rural Alaska for a Medicaid client, we also pay for transportation services to get that Medicaid client to where the services can be provided. So it's much more cost effective if we can work to have services available at the local level. For the most part, some of the specialty services are never going to be able to be provided everywhere. We're working with our tribal partners to develop a strong tribal health system, because for those Medicaid services provided through the tribal health system, for tribal health beneficiaries, we receive 100% federal reimbursement. So we are try very hard to maintain a strong partnership with those tribal providers. And the commissioner has already spoken to some of our electronic efforts in this arena, completing the MMIS system, bringing up a health records exchange environment, and getting our providers converted to electronic health records.
So
Madam Chair, some of you have heard most of the other divisions, and I didn't know whether you wanted me to just cover them briefly. The one area that, because we kind of went out of order in the House HES Committee, that you did not get the benefit of hearing was Division of Public Health. So if you would like me to jump to that, or would you like me to just really quickly cover the ones, all of them through the presentation?
Which one would you prefer? I want to hear from public health.
I can just keep going in order, but I'll be really, really fast on the ones that I think most of you have already heard.
All right.
Okay. Division of Juvenile Justice is next. Our Juvenile Justice Director, Barb Hinchin, is also here in the audience with us, I think. Is Barb here? No? Okay. Sorry. Barb is came to us as she had previously been the superintendent at McLaughlin. We're very fortunate that she was able to join us as director when Steve McComb retired, because she knows the system inside and out. We have 479 full-time staff in the Division of Juvenile Justice. They operate 8 youth detention facilities in Anchorage, Matsu, Kenai, Fairbanks, Bethel, Nome, Juneau, and Ketchikan, and 16 juvenile probation offices throughout the state. Again, this is a 24/7 environment, so you have to keep in mind when you look at the staffing levels that we're operating several shifts throughout the day. McLaughlin specializes in services not provided anywhere else in the state. They offer institutional programs, for example, for male sex offenders. When we have a youth that is referred to the system that could utilize those services, we transfer them into McLaughlin in order for them to be able to receive them. Our Division of Public Assistance right now is being headed up by Ron Creer as the acting director. Ron is another very longtime employee who stepped into this role the 1st of January upon the former division director's retirement. We have 535 staff in the Division of Public Assistance, and they operate through 15 full-service field offices throughout the state. Most of these field offices are co-located with job service offices. We serve over 174,000 people throughout the state through the public assistance programs offered. We offer a variety of public assistance programs, everything from our assistance to temporary assistance to Families in Need program, and our food stamp program, our senior benefits program, our heating assistance program, our adult public assistance program, and our women, infant, and children program. And then we do all of the eligibility determination for Medicaid through this particular division. We continue to struggle to meet increased caseloads with essentially a static level of staff, and this division has been very successful in converting their practices through the use of Lean, which has enabled them to really improve processing time. And we continue to expand those Lean processes through our field offices. We've got it fully implemented in Anchorage, and we're working to expand it throughout the state. Public health. Our public health division is headed up by our chief medical officer, Dr. Ward Hurlburt. And Dr. Ward is here, right behind me. This division has 507 full-time people and 11 part-time people. The operations for this division include public health nursing, and they have locations throughout the state at public health nurse centers. They also do all of the vital statistics record keeping. They operate 2 public health labs, one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks. They provide infectious disease and epidemic prevention and control. They provide certification and licensing for numerous healthcare facilities throughout the state, and they also do the background checks for all health service providers that are subject to that requirement, and they manage the state medical examiner's office and oversee the grant program for emergency medical services throughout the state. The challenges that this division has faced, we referred to some in terms of our program priority areas, the first, of course, being the fight against chronic disease. And that includes, as the commissioner pointed out, an awful lot of lifestyle choices that could be improved upon to reduce both the cost to the medical system and lost productivity. We need to improve the childhood immunization rates to prevent the spread of infectious disease. Our Alaska childhood immunization rate for two-year-olds in 2009 was ranked 49th among all 50 states at 56.6% compared to a 70.5% average for the U.S. This is an area that also struggles greatly with the shortage of healthcare workforce because of the number of nurses and doctors that we employ in these various areas. And we are working to improve some of our statewide coverages for public health, most notably through the state medical examiner's office, which has been primarily a medical examiner operation serving Anchorage and Mat-Su. We are trying to make that more of a true statewide function. And we have been very fortunate in the last couple of years, we have actually been able to hire forensic pathologists for this operation. And prior to that, we were using locum tenens, and it made it very, very difficult. So I think we're seeing some significant improvements in this area. Madam Chair, the next division I want to speak about is the Division of Senior and Disability Services. This division has 148 full-time staff and 3 part-time staff. We also make significant use of long-term non-perms in this division in order to conduct the assessments necessary for the 4 Medicaid waiver programs and the personal care attendant program. We have over 4,800 individuals in fiscal year 10 on Medicaid waiver programs. The 4 Medicaid waiver programs are the children with complex medical conditions. This is a relatively small program. And then 3 larger programs, the adults with physical disabilities, the older Alaskans waiver, and the developmental disabilities waiver. These programs are designed to provide alternate approaches to long-term care. So the individuals that are eligible for these programs are individuals who otherwise meet nursing home level of care and the financial criteria that would allow them admission to nursing homes were home and community-based services not available. In addition to that, we also provide protective services for adults through this division. This is comparable to our child protective services, but for those vulnerable adults. And here we're talking about individuals over the age of 18. And we manage a number of grant programs through this division for senior and developmentally disabled services throughout the state. This program manages all of the nutrition, transportation, and support service grants throughout the state for the senior programs, Meals on Wheels type programs, and for many home and community-based service programs. In addition, in this division, you will find for administrative purposes the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Governor's Council on Special Education and Developmental Disabilities. Finally, Madam Chair, is our Department Support Services Program. This is the program that I oversee, and it includes all of our administrative support functions, our IT functions, the Commissioner's Office, our public information team, and we oversee 2 grant programs, the Human Service Matching Grant Program and the Community Initiative Matching Grant Program. Madam Chair, that concludes our department overview.
Thank you. Are there any questions, comments to be made before we move on? Senator Dyson?
I'm sorry. Move on to what?
We have another presentation from
the
Health Commission.
Yeah, I had a few questions, if I may. Commissioner, in a sidebar conversation you and I had, I remember you saying that the department has something around 3,000 to 4,000 payees, folks you pay to provide services. I'm thinking of assisted living homes, you know, foster care homes, and all those kind of things.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we have a total of 11,000 providers, about 3,600 of which are located in the state of Alaska.
Okay. All right.
If that's what you were after.
Yes, sir. Sorry, I wasn't more precise. We've also had some conversations in the past about what's going on nationally with medical fraud and your concern about what is going on here. Would you kind of give my colleagues a little summary of your understanding of the situation?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, there are a lot of federal efforts presently being undertaken around fraud, waste, and abuse nationally. At your rather persuasive urging, I've met with the Attorney General, and he and I are looking at consolidating our efforts in-state in addition to trying to figure out how we're going to work with all the federal programs that are coming in to begin to take this over. We have the Medicaid Integrity Program coming in. We have a replacement for our Myers-Stauffer surveys that is coming in to begin doing the federal audits. And in addition, our own efforts, both around provider fraud, abuse, misuse, if you will, and recipient fraud and misuse, we need to step up those programs and are stepping up those programs to address that.
I'm glad you mentioned provider fraud. As I understand, on a national level, the stuff that clients cheat is minuscule compared to what some of the providers are doing. Can you give us an idea of what the level percentage-wise is on a national level and what we might expect it is here?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I don't know the exact percentages, but hopefully we're not as good as some of the other states are at fraud. The state of Florida has identified a mafia-like organization, as well as the state of New York now has identified a mafia-like organization who basically was exercising Medicare fraud in the billions of dollars. And it remains to be seen what we have here, but on a percentage basis, I wouldn't hazard a guess on that, sir.
In passing, you mentioned some percentage of our costs that were related to behavioral problems or self-induced medical issues. What was it you said, sir?
The percentage, through the chair, Senator Dyson, that we are asking the percentage?
Well, whatever it was you said about...
What I spoke about was, I believe, $600 million was the direct medical cost, and $1.9 billion is lost work time cost related to basically self-inflicted health care issues.
In our state. As I understand a conversation with somebody, actually I think works in administration, but they said we may be paying $9 or $10 million for obesity-related problems for state employees. Does that sound like that's in the ballpark?
Senator Dyson, I'm not able to answer that, but the person sitting right behind me
is nodding vigorously.
Does have that number.
All right. And as I understand it, the pharmacy board is months, if not longer, away from having our drug registry finished.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that has been a slow-moving process. I believe that bill actually passed the year that Lida Green left office. So that's 3 years ago, and we're hoping to see that come soon.
We all are, but do you have an anticipated time or know of it?
Through the chair, Senator Dice, we've been cut out of that loop.
Thank you. Who would?
I believe that's through the Department of Administration, or I believe it's Commerce.
Commerce.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you for your overview. You know, yes.
Question?
You may.
Yeah, there was a group I met with last week. I think they were at the last police council. And they were mentioning that there were some funds available for parents who either adopt foster kids or maybe have kids of their own that are high risk behavioral or psychiatric issues. That there's some funds available to help these parents buy additional things for the house.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, you may be speaking about our subsidized adoption and guardianship program that the Office of Children's Services runs. TANF. Okay, that is our temporary assistance for needy families program.
And if I may, Chair, one other question.
Thank you.
You know, one, I read somewhere that Alaska is in the top 10 as far as our youth not smoking tobacco or not using tobacco. And a lot of times we see ourselves, especially unfortunately with health issues, being in the bottom 10. So I was very proud of that fact, and that's something that I've worked hard on as well. But I think a lot of that just has to do with protecting the tobacco settlement funds that we've got. Other states have used that for other things. And it's been a while now, a couple of years since I've been in finance, but I always tried to make sure we protected that money. Is that money still being protected in these purposes?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, there are no new purposes for which that money is being used other than those that you would be familiar with from your experience. Yes. And we do have proposed in our FY12 budget an increment that would be funded by tobacco funds, but specifically for cessation work.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since the comment was made, I've been pondering why the gubernatorial election would have affected the timetable for selecting the permanent director of Children's Services. I don't understand that. Why would the election of a governor affect who's looking out for the kids? We were going to have a governor of some sort, regardless, and can somebody explain that to me?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, it comes down to it. The directors are gubernatorial appointees, and nobody wanted to take the job temporarily between August and December if they thought that we were going to get a different governor, or the possibility of a different governor, or the governor not choosing them to be in the position. We had, I believe, two or three positions that went into acting status for that exact reason.
So no one wanted the job under those circumstances?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, yes, no one wanted the job.
All right, we do have another presentation, and if there are other questions, or you can get with the respective person later. We're going to get a report on the commission, health commission at this time.
All right, Deb, it's yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Deborah Erickson, for the record. I'm the director of the Alaska Healthcare Commission, and joining me today is Dr. Ward Hurlburt, who is not only the chief medical officer for the Department of Health and Social Services, and as well as the public health director, but also is the designated chair for the Healthcare Commission. And I have a presentation today. I know the senators on the committee received a copy of the report in their packet, as well as a copy of this presentation. And I thought it would be helpful to take a few minutes just to reflect on the history of healthcare reform attempts in Alaska before we get started on catching up on where the Alaska Healthcare Commission is today in addressing health reform. There have been a number of organizations formed, a couple under an administrative order by the governor, another by the legislature, and a couple of private organizational groups over the past 25 years or so, formed to try to address the questions and concerns about accessibility and affordability and quality of health care in the state. All of these groups have met, have been convened somewhat on an ad hoc basis for anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half to 2 years to address this question. And the creation of the commission now is in statute is the first attempt to try to provide some long-term sustainable look at healthcare access issues and cost issues. I wanted to start off too by highlighting a projection that was made by one of these earlier groups. The Health Resources and Access Task Force was created by the legislature in 1991 to address the concerns about accessibility of health care. Senator Ellis actually served on this body, I believe. And at the time, this group was projecting, a consultant of theirs projected that if some changes weren't made to how healthcare is organized and financed in the state, that we would see healthcare expenditures in the state rising from, at the time, a little over $1.5 billion total, all expenditures for healthcare in the state, to by 2003 exceeding $5.5 billion. And the most recent report estimating healthcare spending in the state was from 2005, using 2005 data. ICER at that point estimated that about $5.5 billion was being spent in 2005 on healthcare reform. So because no changes were made in the healthcare system, and interestingly, those projections made all of those years ago are panning out. Just another note about the significance specifically to state government in Alaska, but I think it's helpful to get a sense of the context of overall what opportunity costs might be and trade-offs we might be making in terms of policy choices amongst state government leaders, but also to think about the sorts of policy choices that might be having to be made at the local level and even at a family level when you think about how healthcare costs have increased so significantly. And this is just a sense of comparing Medicaid expenditures for the Department of Health and Social Services expenditures. These are taking the BRUs where health claims are paid, as well as the Healthcare Services Administration, budgeted for the current state fiscal year 11. Operating budget is $1.4 billion for Medicaid costs. And that's compared to, here on this slide, the total appropriation. This is for the entire Department of Education, the entire Department of Transportation, the state operating budget, all funding sources. You can see the Medicaid appropriation matches the entire appropriation for the State Department of Education, is twice the appropriation of the operating budget for the Department of Transportation, goes on down from there. Budget for the University of Alaska system, operating budget, $0.8 billion. Down to the Department of Corrections, all funding sources, $0.3 billion. Again, I just wanted to provide some context for how state government spending is increasing. This doesn't capture how much is the state is spending in other areas for healthcare, for example, employee and retiree health insurance, medical costs for the Department of Corrections, those sorts of things. I think some of the leadership for the commission and for the Department of Health and Social Services assumes partly that this is what's driven the legislature and the administration to take a stronger interest in actually establishing a permanent body and statute now. The Healthcare Commission was actually initially created by Governor Palin under an administrative order, and that body met for a year during calendar year 2009 and released a report on the work that they conducted during 2009, just about a year ago. And that body terminated with the release of that report. But then the legislature established the commission in statute through SB 172 in April of this past year. That bill was transmitted to the governor and signed into law in June. New members were appointed in September. Just a note that there was a transition clause in that bill that retained the former members appointed to the initial commission. There were also four more seats added. And so those new members were appointed in September. The new commission just started meeting in October 2010, but we did managed to release a report for 2010, really reflects about 3 months worth of work of that body so far. And that's the report that you have before you today. The statute establishing the commission now describes the purpose as fostering the development of a statewide plan to address quality, accessibility, and availability of healthcare for all citizens of the state. And the main duties laid out in the statute are that this body will serve as the state health planning and coordinating body. We are charged with fostering the development of a comprehensive statewide healthcare policy and also developing a strategy for improving the health of all Alaskans. And then one of our other duties is to provide an annual report to the legislature and the governor by January 15th of each year. And so these reports will be coming out reflecting the work that will be done on a calendar year basis. There are now 11 voting members with seats designated for various representatives of different parts of the healthcare industry, as well as some other sectors. The business community is represented, the Mental Health Trust Authority, and the federal government has a seat through specifically representing the healthcare industry for the VA, the Veterans Administration. And as I mentioned before, the statute specifically designates the department's chief medical officer as the chair of the body. And there are also three non-voting members, one each representing the House of Representatives and the Senate, and then the Office of the Governor has a seat as well. In the first year, I think one of the things I wanted to mention, especially with the transition where we were able to retain kind of the core membership from the initial body, while this 2010 report is just based on 3 months' worth of work, it also builds on, picks up where the 2009 commission left off. So we're not recreating the wheel there. And we've been able to kind of reaffirm with a new group the work that was initially conducted in 2009. And so in this slide, we've described what we identified in that first year as kind of a five-year planning process, the framework for strategic planning. And we designed a process meant to evolve over a five-year period that can be built on each year, where we're starting off with developing a vision of what the ideal healthcare system in Alaska will look like and deliver a set of goals and a set of values for the ideal healthcare system for the state. And then, this is, looks very linear. It really is more of a circular process, an iterative process, where we are trying to take time each year with better understanding the current conditions of the system, to understand where we're at in developing strategies for then moving towards a transformed system for the state. Part of that identifying what the foundation for a strong healthcare system would look like, the components, the building blocks for a strengthened healthcare system, and then identifying policies, strategies for improving the system over time, and then throughout each year also measuring progress and how recommendations that have been made previously by the commission are being implemented. And we're also, this year, we'll be coming up with a set of indicators for reporting back to the legislature and the governor each year on certain key measures of how the Alaska's healthcare system is performing. Just a quick note about the vision that was defined by that earlier group, reaffirmed now by our new commission, is that the Alaska's healthcare system will focus on improving health status, delivering value, looking at cost and quality improvements, and also developing a system where both providers and recipients of care, consumers and patients, are satisfied with the services and the care that they receive. And also that the system will be sustainable. And that's been a significant concern of the commission, is that the healthcare system, the way it's designed today, is not sustainable in the long run. The sustainability concern comes both into the vision as well as, you can see, in the values. First value for the reformed healthcare system is that it will be sustainable. Goals of increasing access, controlling costs, improving quality, and making the system more prevention-based. And values that focus not just on sustainability, but on improving efficiency and effectiveness of care, emphasizing the importance of individual choice and also personal engagement in care. You'll see how that comes out in the strategy framework that the group has developed. As far as the work that the commission's previously did and is continuing to do to describe the current healthcare system, the commission's first report in 2009 included an appendix that provides a description of how healthcare services are organized in the state, how they're delivered, explains the different sectors that involved in healthcare delivery, the military and VA, the tribal health system, the private healthcare system, as well as all the different financing streams for paying for care in the state. And so there's a description of that in the first report. There's also identification of a number of issues and problems with the current system in that report. In 2010, the little bit of time that we have had, we decided the one thing that we might be able to do to add value in understanding the current system was to provide an overview of the new federal healthcare reform law. There is a brief summary of that law included in the 2010 report. There's also some bulleted information on what's happened during calendar year 2010 in Alaska related to implementation of various provisions that have started to be implemented by the federal government. And there's information included in the appendix. Any information that we were aware of that had been released to the public so far that provides some information on what the state of Alaska and state agencies are looking at related to that law. And there also had been some early work done by ICER and an economist that has worked with ICER on analyzing healthcare in the state in the past, took some of the national models for projecting impact, very high level economic and other healthcare system impacts. The commission contracted with ICER for that economic consultant, Mark Foster, to kind of finalize that work for a point in time anyway and provide a report. And a draft chart pack right now is included. His information is included in the report. We expect to get a final report in narrative form from him in the next month, and that'll be posted to our website as soon as it's finalized. Also, in our in this past quarter and described in this report, the commission started planning for 2011 of what we might look at and need to start studying next to add to information and understanding about the current condition of the system. And we've contracted with ICER to do a new analysis of total health care spending in the state, with a little bit more focus on helping to analyze what the cost drivers are. We also are close to being ready to release an RFP to contract with a healthcare actuarial firm to provide a comprehensive review and an analysis of healthcare pricing and reimbursement for services in the state. And we provide some anecdotal information in the 2009 report and identify concerns related to the extent to which prices for healthcare services in the state might be higher than other states. We want to have a more comprehensive study by a third party to look at how prices in Alaska compare to other states in our region, Oregon and Idaho, and also a couple other states close to our region that might more closely reflect Alaska's rural nature as well as our healthcare delivery system organization. So we're looking to have a comparison to Wyoming and North Dakota as well. And then another component of understanding what's driving costs is the health of Alaskans. And so we'll be looking to the Department of Health and Social Services to help with a health status assessment this year as well. And then we're also starting to look ahead to 2012 and beyond, additional components of health care and health care costs to understand the system better and look for opportunities for improvement. I'll just go quickly through some of these slides here, and you can refer to them for more information to the report, or certainly we can come back and answer questions that you might have. In addition to an overview of how healthcare is delivered and financed, the 2009 report identified the concerns beyond specifically the high and rising and unsustainable cost of care in the state. Provide some information on insurance coverage, describes the logistical challenges of delivering care and some of the loss of economies of scale related to those as well, the system fragmentation and duplication, workforce shortages and distribution of the workforce are big concerns, health status and the extent to which health conditions and health risk behaviors are driving those problems and how that leads to increased utilization and services. And then one specific, beyond leadership challenges that have partly been addressed anyway with the creation of the Healthcare Commission now, health information technology development and the importance of that in moving our healthcare system forward. One specific problem that was studied in 2009, we provide a little bit of an update on where we're at with that in the state, is the problem of access to primary care for Medicare beneficiaries, particularly in urban, especially in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm going to move on to what the commission is using right now based on the work of the earlier commission for what we're characterizing as our a picture of where we're going for transforming healthcare. And it focuses on the importance of emphasizing and enhancing the consumer's role in health. And two aspects of that, both the individual Alaskans and Alaskan families' responsibility for living healthy lifestyles, looking at what communities and what state government can do to provide supports for those folks and living healthier lifestyles. And also looking at the medical care side of the equation, what innovations are there in patients' experience of care and delivery of care, especially around primary care, but how we can make that care more patient-centered so that individuals have more of a role in making decisions about their care and are better able to take responsibility and supporting their role in seeing through treatment plans and those sorts of things and participating in those. And so that's kind of the pinnacle, and we're looking at policies. Policies are organized really around our different goals of access, value, and being more prevention-based. You'll see some of those, examples of those, but it's all focused on improving at the patient's experience of health care, medical services, and making those services more innovative and supporting individuals to live healthier lifestyles. And then the three building blocks for that we've identified as the foundation for a transformed system. Another area where we're developing recommendations and identifying policy options are ways to strengthen the healthcare workforce, improve deployment of health information technology, and then provide strong leadership for improvement. These next several slides just provide pictures of to describe the different strategies that the Commission might be considering over time. These are included in the report as an appendix, both in kind of a listed form. There's a narrative description of each of these, but I just wanted to give you a sense of where we're at with the, and there's a color coding showing where the Commission is at and development and study of these different strategies. So just in terms of improving value, in 2009, there's a recommendation the Commission made related to primary care innovation. In this year, the one strategy the Commission spent time studying and developed recommendations around evidence-based medicine, and in 2011, we'll be looking at price and quality transparency and a couple of strategies related to value-driven purchasing. We'll be looking at a couple of strategies specifically related to increasing insurance coverage, specific to improving financial access in 2011. Looking at improving access to information for addressing prevention, developing and identifying measures for healthcare system improvement in 2011, continuing to track how things are going related to implementing health information technology and also workforce development, and measuring progress. So the 2010 report is laid out really in three different sections. There's an introduction that provides this kind of the background and an overview of the planning framework and process and the activities that we were able to address in 2010. And then both related to studying the current system and developing recommendations for improvement. We've summarized what we studied in 2009, provided information, as I explained, related to federal reform, and laid out plans for 2011. And again, did the same thing related to recommendations for system change, and have provided a report on what's happened related to 2009 recommendations, the new recommendations for 2010, and strategies that we'll be studying in 2011.
I have a question before we have to wrap up at 3 o'clock.
Yes.
This committee has often asked why a medical procedure at Providence Hospital in Anchorage sometimes cost a third more than it does at Virginia Mason or Swedish in Seattle, a few hundred miles south, more than a few hundred miles, but our neighbor to the south. And Linda Hall, director of insurance, has been asked about this before by this committee and other committees, if she will use the federal money that's available to states to figure that out, to compare costs and try to figure out the costs and make efficiencies in the system. Linda Hall's refusing to use that federal money that's available to us or to apply for that money to find out what we're asking to know, presumably because the governor isn't interested in participating in anything to do with the federal health care reform. Is that money available to your group to do such work, to provide us with the information that the legislature is anxious to have?
Senator Ellis, through the chair, my understanding of those that federal funding opportunity is that the governor has to sign the application to accept those funds. the Healthcare Commission, I understand, too, that there also are questions about exactly how those resources might be used. They're specifically for reviewing insurance rates. But the commission is very interested in healthcare pricing and reimbursement, and that's why we are in the process of developing a solicitation for a contract for a health actuarial firm to come in and do that analysis for the commission specifically.
Well, having that information one way or another through whatever form or avenue would be very helpful to our work.
It would be. We're about to run out of time. Is there any other questions for the members that are that's left before she can wrap up? You're none. You may continue.
What I would do at this point, Madam Chair, I think is just refer the anyone in the audience to the website. This presentation lays out just a quick overview of some of the major initiatives that have been implemented and activities that have occurred related to the Commission's 2009 recommendations. Another thing I would note is that those recommendations stand and they're ongoing. We're trying to build a picture over time of how we can improve the healthcare system. These aren't just annual one-time recommendations that will go away at the end of each year. Dr. Hurlburt and I certainly are available to meet individually with members of the committee who might want to get into more detail or have additional questions, or are happy to follow up in the future.
Thank you. If there's no other questions and you have completed your overview at this time, we are going to adjourn at 3 o'clock. Thank the members for being here. Thank you also.